All right, everybody. It is a Friday night here on Cairo Radio. We are Cairo Knights. We being Mace and Mike. Frank Shires is here, of course.
Present.
You just heard him. You're going to hear him again at the top and bottom of the hours, giving you the news. And, of course, DB, David Burbank, a.k.a. D-Bank, a.k.a. D-Money, is on the ones and twos. I want to start out the show, not to get all Willard Scott on everybody, but I want to start a show with a happy birthday wish.
Oh.
Happy birthday to Microsoft's Solitaire, which turns 30 years old today.
You mean the program?
Yeah, the game on the computer. 30 years old today. It first debuted as part of Windows 3.0. That was in 1990. And the idea behind it was to give people something that could teach them how to use a mouse. Because we were pretty unfamiliar with mices at that time. So you had a game that was all click, drag, drop, and it blew up into what it is today. Apparently, according to Microsoft, 35 million people still play Solitaire every month.
Did they have any stats on how much productivity was lost to Solitaire?
No. Although I did read that the person who designed it, it was an intern for Microsoft named Wes Cherry, and they originally designed it with like a boss button where you could hit a button and like a fake spreadsheet would pop up.
Yeah, they had that for quite a long time, actually.
Well, they made him take it out of the initial releases. I guess they put it back in later, but apparently there's a story that Michael Bloomberg fired a guy for playing Solitaire. And they were like, yeah, should have had that boss button, man.
Exactly.
That would have saved you.
You could hit one button on the keyboard and a random spreadsheet would come up.
Yeah, I love that so much. 989-973, State Roofing text line. If you want to share some birthday wishes for the 30-year-old Solitaire, that's insane. You can get it as a game. Now it's all complex and complicated, but give me that simple Solitaire, and give me those. When you win and those cards all cascade down.
Played it.
Oh, Frank, have I played Solitaire?
I have never touched it.
What?
Not for one
second. Is there anyone out there who has never played? I think you might be it, Frank. You might be the only one.
David, have you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Right. Of course.
Yeah. Frank, sorry, you might guys. Be on.
This is our new top story. Frank Shires has never played Windows Solitaire.
A shocker, I'm sure.
It is. I'm shocked by it. That's cool. Well, anyway, just having a little fun here at the top of the show because we got some news to get to. So let's do it.
Here's the top three things we need to discuss. Number one.
President Trump addressed the nation today during a White House press briefing to update us all on the latest of how the country is reacting to the coronavirus pandemic. And in the briefing, the president announced that he's now deeming all places of worship throughout the country as essential.
Today I'm identifying houses of worship, churches, synagogue, and mosques as essential places that provide essential services.
The president specifically pointed out other essential businesses that have been able to remain open.
Some governors have deemed liquor stores and abortion clinics as essential, but have left out churches and other houses of worship. It's not right. So I'm correcting this injustice and calling houses of worship essential.
We don't gather in mass in liquor stores. But anyway, the president laid out his argument for why they are essential to the American people.
These are places that hold our society together and keep our people united. The people are demanding to go to church and synagogue, go to their mosque. Many millions of Americans embrace worship as an essential part of life. The ministers, pastors, rabbis, imams, and other faith leaders will make sure that their congregations are safe as they gather and pray. I know them well. They love their congregations. They love their people. They don't want anything bad to happen to them or to anybody else.
Trump called out governors, telling them to allow places of worship to reopen immediately.
I call upon governors to allow our churches and places of worship to open right now.
And he really hammered home how important this reopening is to him. He even went so far as to kind of sound like he's threatening governors.
If there's any question, they're going to have to call me, but they're not going to be successful in that call. The governors need to do the right thing and allow these very important essential places of faith to open right now. for this weekend. If they don't do it, I will override the governors.
As for what authority President Trump has to override state governments, that still remains to be seen. But Washington Governor Jay Inslee released a statement through his office this afternoon in response to President Trump's declaration. It read, quote, "Our office continues to work with spiritual leaders and health experts to identify ways to do this safely. While we have read the president's comments, there is no order. There is no order, and we think he understands at this point that he can't dictate what states can or cannot open." End quote. One spiritual leader in Seattle has already responded to the president's announcement. Senior Rabbi Daniel Wiener of the Temple to Hirsch Sinai in Seattle says their local synagogues will remain closed until the disease data and state leaders say it is safe to open back up. The rabbi spoke to Cairo Radio on the phone earlier.
What is key to us in terms of making that decision is what's going on specifically in our state, and what the governor and local public health officials tell us is safe and optimal for our communities.
According to him, opening back up would endanger the congregation as a whole, which is contradictory to most groups of faith.
The idea that religious communities, faith communities, would recklessly put their membership in danger for wanting to live out their faith is something that is just anathema to us.
Michael Ramos of the Church Council of Greater Seattle also spoke to Cairo Radio, and he recommended that all churches across the county stay closed.
The health of our people is paramount, and while it is extremely important to keep praying, gathering together should be done with a great level of care and preparation.
Ramos proposed a gradual opening of churches, aligning with the governor's four-phased plan to reopen.
A gradual opening, beginning with perhaps outdoor gatherings, might be coming into place, and at the same time, smaller gatherings.
In the meantime, most places of worship across Washington are finding ways to reach their congregations, and with sermons streaming online each week, most places are finding even better attendance than usual services, because people, for one, no longer have an excuse not to go. I don't know if other religions are like this, but when I grew up, I spent most of my life going to church very, very regularly, multiple times a week, generally speaking. And I was always taught that the church is not the building, that the church is the people. And so if there's a way to get people together, I know it's different. I know you don't get quite that rush that you do when you're together in a group setting. But I think there are ways to do this and to meet your faith needs without necessarily putting people's health in danger.
Well, I mean, it's the world isn't the same as it was. And so you adapt. And you adapt until you can get it back to some semblance of sameness. I don't know that someone who is devout is less saved as a result of staying home another month,
right,
or staying home another week, or whatever it is. And I don't know that necessarily if they're communicating with their religious leader either through a Zoom conference or on a phone or some other manner. I mean, people in Alaska have to do this all the time. I mean, this is not unusual, and there are many people of faith there. I mean, the people who live in remote settings have to do this all the time.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It doesn't seem like too much to ask, because what we're talking about isn't whether or not a church for many people is as essential as a liquor store, as the president said.
Absolutely.
The problem is the gathering size, and that is really what we're talking about here. At least that's what the health experts are talking about here.
Number two.
If you have heard any of the President Trump's press briefings over the last 2 months, you've heard him tout an anti-malarial drug, hydroxychloroquine.
There you go.
I always make sure I get the first time through that one. It's always tough. As being a good treatment for the coronavirus. Here's what the president had to say about it.
If things don't go as planned, it's not going to kill anybody. I think it gives you an additional level of safety. But you can ask many doctors who are in favor of it. It's had a great reputation. And if it was somebody else other than me, people would say, gee, isn't that smart? A lot of people swear by it. It's gotten a bad reputation only because I'm promoting it. So I'm obviously a very bad promoter. I've taken it, I think, just about 2 weeks. I think it's another day. So, and I'm still here.
Well, now, a large-scale study of the drug's effects on coronavirus patients has been published in The Lancet, demonstrating that the drug is, in fact, detrimental to patients' health. CNN's senior medical correspondent Elizabeth Cohen has more.
This is a study that was led by folks at Harvard and was published in The Lancet just today. They looked at six patients in 671 hospitals. So these were hospitalized coronavirus patients on six continents, nearly 15,000 of these patients receiving hydroxychloroquine or chloroquine, often in combination with other drugs. What they found is that those who were taking hydroxychloroquine or chloroquine were 33% to 45% more likely to die, even after they adjusted, because there were some differences between patients who weren't taking the drug, who were taking the drugs, and a control group who was not. Also, the patients taking the drugs were between 2.4 and 5 times more likely to develop heart arrhythmias. Again, these are hospitalized patients, but still, President Trump has painted with a broad brush, saying, why not try it? This study tells you why not try it.
Internal medicine and viral specialist Dr. Jorge Rodriguez also weighed in on the study.
Let me put it this way. People were sick to begin with. If you didn't take any of these medications, 9% of the people died. If you took the combination of hydroxychloroquine and an antibiotic, 25% died. That is 3 times more people died when on this medication.
In addition, Dr. Rodriguez explained how the drug can cause heart arrhythmia in patients.
This medication, the hydroxychloroquine, can prolong the time between the chambers of the heart communicating with each other, and you can have all these erratic arrhythmias. So if people wanted proof, there already has been proof that hydroxychloroquine does not help with the COVID virus. But now there's proof that not only doesn't it help, but when you're really sick, it is life-threatening and dangerous, period.
The president has encouraged that Americans, especially first responders, take the drug as a preventative measure, citing that it will protect them from contracting the virus. According to Dr. Rodriguez, this is not true.
As of now, there is absolutely no evidence. There has been no study that has shown that taking hydroxychloroquine prophylactically, which means to prevent getting the COVID virus, is helpful.
Sales of hydroxychloroquine have soared in the U.S. since March, since the president began recommending it. According to CNN, more than 830,000 prescriptions of the drug were filled for the generic and brand name versions of the drug, Plaquenil, in March, roughly from 460,000 prescriptions written during the same time last year. So it's roughly doubled. Some bright news, though. University of Washington Medicine has been working on trials with the antiviral drug remdesivir, looking at how much it affects those who have been hospitalized with COVID-19. Dr. Helen Chu, an assistant professor of allergy and infectious diseases at the University of Washington School of Medicine, reported the following about the trials. Quote, the main take-home messages is that remdesivir is effective in reducing the duration of illness in people who are hospitalized with COVID-19, but obviously it's not a cure-all. There is still a very high mortality rate in both groups. It gives us something to work with, but we will need other treatments to stop this antiviral and to really improve outcomes. The study so far has included roughly 1,000 patients, with about half receiving remdesivir, the other half receiving a placebo in a double-blind test.
Number 3.
The CDC sent guidance out this week updating the United States on how coronavirus is most likely to be transmitted between people. Here's more with ABC World News' David Muir.
So here's what the CDC is saying tonight, and they said they have said this before, that COVID-19 spreads mainly through close contact from person to person, and while it may be possible that a person can get COVID by touching a surface or object that has the virus on it and then touching their own mouth, nose, or eyes, that's not thought to be the main way, that it's mainly through person to person through respiratory droplets.
Researchers don't yet know whether all speech, cough, and sneeze droplets carrying the particles are equally infectious, or if a specific amount of virus needs to be transmitted for a person to get sick by breathing it in. But a study last week found that talking alone can launch thousands of droplets into the air, and that they can remain suspended for 8 to 14 minutes. That was in the New York Times. The CDC, however, is still recommending wiping down and disinfecting regularly touched surfaces and thoroughly washing your hands regularly.
It's interesting that it's nice to see that they're getting a little bit more. We're sort of circling in on the likely transmission vectors, because that's pretty important. It's difficult all the time to police everything that someone touches. And if it looks like that is not as likely a transmission route, although we still certainly don't know that, and there's no reason to sort of let off, it just gives you a little bit more confidence that when you do grab something, you pick something up and you forgot, man, I didn't wipe that down, or who was the last person touching it, you don't need to get into that panic mode immediately, because your odds are pretty good that wasn't necessarily a way it was transmitted.
Which, outside of the actual virus itself and the illness and death it could cause, I mean, that mental strain, that mental stress, I think is one of the worst things about it. People are tense. People are upset. People are scared. People are stressed out. They're sleeping bad. They're having nightmares.
Well, they're getting, tense on the sidewalk if you walk too close to somebody. In their estimation, you may be a full 6 feet, but people are doing these kind of crazy things by crossing out to the middle of the street, when you walk by. And I'm thinking, I'm not going to explode. I am. And I'm certainly not like spraying spit in your direction.
Mm-hmm.
But I get it. It's not because they're thinking of me personally. They see everyone,
right.
as a threat in a weird way. And they also see, and they don't, we've had so much information about this, and most of it erring on the side of like increasing the margin of safety. And so when you always err on the larger side, it makes people a little bit tense about what could be a normal distancing, what should be a standard distancing procedure, when it gets to 10 feet and 12 feet, because people feel like that's even safer than the 6 feet, and it's statistically probably not. That level of policing that, I think, wears people out.
Yeah, 100%.
It keeps them cranky.
It makes me, I've reacted weirdly when people are too close. They'll be in the middle of the sidewalk. I'll kind of veer off to one side, and they stay in the middle. And in my head, I'm going like, wait a minute. And then I think it's fine. But early on, the message was assume everyone has it,
right?
And that stays
right.
That's pretty hard to shake. Guys, coming up on the show tonight, it's going to be a fun Friday. If you are a fan of either Madden, the football game, video games or esports in general, or people like just flipping the script on a game that you know and love. We have an 8 o'clock for you. Taylor Jacobs, he's the esports guru from 710 ESPN. He's going to come in and talk about this guy from Mukilteo was in the championship game in the Madden Bowl. He didn't win, but the guy who didn't throw one pass. You hear me, DB? Not one pass in the whole tournament. It is the strangest thing. We're going to tell you how he did it. Also, if you thought we were done talking about Aunt Becky, you're wrong. Aunt Becky's back in the news today.
Of course she is.
Just an example of doing absolutely everything wrong. And eagle-eared listeners will notice we're having some funky music on this Friday. Why? Because it's Funky Friday. That's right. It's the debut. It's all night long. Hang out with us, everybody. Cairo Nights. Let's celebrate. There's a party going on right here. A dedication to last throughout the year. Welcome back to Cairo Nights, everybody. It's Funky Friday. DB, this might be the best idea you've ever had. It puts me in just the right mood. And you're going to get your weekend and then Motown Mondays. I mean, goodness gracious. You're on fire behind that glass wall. Hi, everybody. Hope you're having a good time. I can't believe we're about to talk about what we're going to talk about here. But if in case you were living under a rock, there was the college admissions scandal, Operation Varsity Blues, as it was called, which is a great name. Great name. Apparently, FBI agents are my age and remember the great film Varsity Blues. And the two most high profile people who were kind of ensnared in this scandal, the scandal being a bunch of rich folks, about 50 of them, I think, were busted for getting their kids into these really great colleges by paying people to either fudge their admissions test scores or lie about them being athletes. They even went as far as to, take pictures of them with a soccer ball or in like a rowboat and get in under false pretenses. Well, the two most high-profile people are, of course, the Felicity Huffman, who is an Oscar-nominated actor. She's amazing. And Lori Loughlin, a.k.a. Aunt Becky. And this is a tale of Goofus and Gallant, because Lori Loughlin, she's in the news. Felicity Huffman, sorry, guilty, my bad, spent, what, 2 weeks?
Something like that, yeah.
And she's out. And that was months ago. Aunt Becky, I didn't do anything. I'm innocent. She shows up to court. She's got an attitude. You can't do that in court.
Nope.
And then now we're seeing that she has reached a plea deal. She and her husband, who's the Massimo guy, they're just like they're just a 90s couple, the two of them.
Absolutely.
That they are going to have to do. She herself, she agreed to plead guilty to a count of conspiracy to commit wire and mail fraud. And so if a federal judge okays this, she's going to have to spend 2 months in prison, not 2 weeks, pay a $150,000 fine, be subject to 2 years of supervised release, and do 100 hours of community service.
And he is paying $250,000,
yep.
I think. And
5 months? Yeah, 5 months.
5 months.
And 250 hours.
I'm kind of curious about the discrepancy between their sentencing, that which means that they said, I guess, handed out based on how far into the conspiracy to commit these crimes they were. And so I guess he must have done more. That's sort of the implication, given the differences.
They slapped him with something called honest services wire and mail fraud. I don't know what, in addition to just wire and mail fraud. So I don't know what that is exactly, but I don't know. Can you believe, like, let this be a lesson to everyone that if you get your hand caught in the cookie jar, just admit it. Just admit it.
Well, yeah, so I don't think anyone should have gone to jail.
Really?
No. I don't think anyone should have gone to jail on this. I don't.
Why?
I guess I remained, maybe I'm just stupid, but that's a possibility. It's a strong possibility. There's evidence.
I don't think so, but I'll hear you out
in that favor. One, wealthy people getting better access to things did not shock me. Two, it is absolutely what they did was absolutely a federal offense. So, so you can associate that with jail. You could also just associate with the fine and probation.
Sure.
What it does is tell you that it is a system flaw, and aside from the human flaw, if you look at these elite colleges and how they admit people, it has been so heavily weighted to the wealthy and the privileged,
yeah,
that these folks stepped a little farther over a line that had been crossed years and years ago,
sure,
by these schools.
Sure.
If you went to a school prior, if you went to Yale, your kids get a legacy admission.
Right.
Now,
right,
does that absolutely create a feedback loop of like the privileged who got in and then their kids get? Yes, it absolutely does. If you went to a private school that prepped you for these schools, which essentially means if you were wealthy growing up,
mm-hmm,
your admission rate is spectacularly higher than average student. Well, so my point is that we are getting all unhappy about 50 people. 50 people,
sure,
who are getting greater access to Stanford. I don't care. I cannot tell you how much I don't care. And here's why I don't care. Because it is the very tip of the iceberg,
sure,
on how corrupt the college admissions thing is. And this is going to get all the scandal. You know what also didn't happen in this whole process?
Don't tell me college people didn't go to jail.
No one in the university has got a hand slap.
Yeah, now that's insane. Because the reason I don't mind
this system.
The reason I don't mind it is because this is, yeah, it's the tip of the iceberg, but I think these 50 people are being used as an example, right?
For what? Which rich person who has their kid in SAT prep classes and an elite school that grooms you, that literally prepares your application,
mm-hmm,
which one of those parents is now dissuaded from using that same system available to them and not available to the average student?
Well,
to a poor student.
Well, nobody's going to stop doing that, but I tend to not be so angry at that, because parents are going to use any resource that they can to
like
do whatever
parents,
is best for,
like,
their,
exactly,
for their child.
Like these parents
and
did.
And so the onus of the responsibility to me is on the schools, making sure that they're taking in an economically diverse student body,
but
they have requirements that they have to meet.
But the schools didn't get anything here. This is why I'm saying I don't care about these 50 people. I don't. If they had gone back to these 50 people and said, you know what, you're going to get a $1 million fine, a $500,000 fine, whatever. All of that money is going to be paid for five kids without the funds, but with the academic chops to get into this school.
Right.
So that's what you're going to do. And tell you what, we'll make you a deal. Every wealthy parent who's making $5 million a year or more, you want to get into Stanford? Your kids are in. We'll take them. It doesn't even matter if they have a pulse.
Right.
We will take them.
Right.
If you pay for
somebody else.
10 other students.
Yeah.
And you can get your kid in all day long. Now, that's a system I could go for, because the fact is that if you come from a wealthy family, your likelihood of ending up as a wealthy person is exceptionally high.
Sure.
So we already know that we're dealing with a privileged group of people that we're now making.
They
this
don't
great,
even need this.
We're
education.
Getting this making this great show of slapping them on the hands. And we're all sort of like getting together like, yeah, now the system's fixed. No, it's not. It was never, never fixed. And this has been a distraction from what is a spectacularly unfair system of college admissions in the United States that looks to get an elite group of people and keep them elite and not let everyone else through that barrier except in very small ways.
Yeah.
I think this has been a dog and pony show that's been an embarrassment, complete embarrassment. If Felicity Huffman and Lori Loughlin spent zero time in jail, would I spend a moment worried about that? Nope. But am I more worried about the people who actually do not get prepped, who do not get allowed into these schools because they interview well, but they didn't get the SAT score classes that only wealthy families can afford?
Right.
Nah.
I don't disagree with you that there's an institutional issue. It's just I love a dog and pony show.
Not me. I like dogs. I like ponies. I hate them in a show.
We're Karenites after this. Happy Funky Friday, everybody. You're listening to Cairo Knights. Mason Mike. 98973. That's the State Roofing text line. Coming up at 9 o'clock, Stacy Joe. We're going to spend Fridays with Stacy. Been doing that. It's kind of been Stacy Joe week here on the show. We just get into these great long conversations with her, and it's about the stuff that's going on with Quentin Dunbar, who was drafted by the Seahawks. Picked up by the Seahawks, is in a kerfuffle in Florida. There are accusations of armed robbery.
That legally you can refer to anything with handguns as kerfuffle.
Oh no. Okay.
A scrape.
A sitch.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He got caught up in some stuff. So we're going to talk about it at 9 with Stacy Joe. And of course, Taylor Jacobs, good friend. He's been on the show. A couple times, I think, Mike, since you've been on the show once or
every
twice.
Every time we have a good video game story, it's always fun to talk to him about that.
Love this guy.
Madden. If any of you have played it, you're really going to want to listen to this. Even if you haven't played it, but you're a gamer, you're going to want to listen to this because it's a great story involving, to a small degree, someone from Mukilteo, but also a guy who won a Madden championship, and he figured out essentially a hack.
Yeah.
In Madden to win the national championship, which comes with tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, like $65,000 or something.
And he's a professional gamer. This is what he does for a living. And it turns out that all of the gamers in these games are essentially looking for that secret hack. It's a really interesting conversation with Taylor.
Yeah, love it. But now, okay, let's talk about Goldman Sachs for a second, because they're in the news again. New York Times has a great piece on them today. They had a part in the financial crisis of 2008, when the housing market collapsed and there were all these mortgage issues and all that stuff. And so to kind of make amends there, they were like, all right, well, we'll give a $1.8 billion to struggling homeowners. But Goldman Sachs is going to Goldman Sachs. And apparently they have now become one of the biggest buyers of distressed mortgages, which means that, like, if people can't pay their mortgage, Goldman Sachs comes in and buys them out and kicks them out of their homes. And they've done it on like 10,000 homes so far.
Yeah. So it's a little bit it's almost that. What it is a distressed mortgage is owned by a mortgage company somewhere. And so sometimes in this case, Goldman Sachs buys the mortgage from the mortgage holder.
Right.
For less than its value, because this company does, it's like a bill collector situation. You can buy someone's old debt and then go to collect it yourself. And you get the old debt for pennies on the dollar. It's the way to get to move debt off your books. And someone else is like, all right, I'll pay you for it. I'll take the risk that I can collect on this thing. So that's what Goldman Sachs has done in a big way here with bad mortgages. But what Goldman Sachs, according to their settlement with the government, Goldman Sachs was supposed to provide $1.8 billion in relief for homeowners, for distressed homeowners. And so the way they were doing it is this. And they have done some of that, just not maybe as much of it as they should. And so what they do is, what that means is you do a couple of things. One, you either give them, you renegotiate terms that allow them to continue making payments. And certainly there's been a bunch of cases. They bought about 30,000 home mortgages. That's what Goldman Sachs, you know, got picked up to help out.
Okay.
Some of them, they negotiated new deals with people, and they allowed them to get onto terms that they could then meet their mortgage payments. So let's just set those aside. That's kind of what it was supposed to do.
Right.
The other thing it was supposed to do was to allow people to walk away from mortgages they were never going to be able to afford, but walk away. So this debt would not follow them around, the $200,000 or $400,000 that they had not paid. Now, that mortgage goes to the person who bought it, which would be Goldman Sachs in this particular case. But that person doesn't have to carry the debt load. And that is, that is a form of mortgage relief, and that is also okay, provided that they gave them every opportunity to actually try to come up with a payment plan.
Right.
But for some people, it was not going to happen. They either lost their job or they just never could afford it. And I don't know if Goldman Sachs in every one of those cases was willing to change the terms, because a lot of these mortgages that defaulted, many of them were what was referred to as an adjustable rate mortgage. So you were low, 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 spectacularly high. And when it did that high, that's when they started defaulting like crazy. Mm. So the third thing that they were supposed to do was to acquire a whole bunch of mortgages, sit on them, and then sell these houses at a profit.
Right.
And it looks like they were maybe doing that to too great of a degree. And that was the problem. And it seems like some of the people in the feds are saying that they stepped outside their agreement. They did the bare minimum possible with this agreement. And then they went back to, which is going to shock a lot of folks, they went back to being Goldman Sachs. And suddenly, they're just now turning a profit on all these distressed mortgages that they had access to.
Scorpion's going to scorpion.
Absolutely it is.
More Kyra Knights after this.